History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that deserve to be told. Our job is to ask a few questions and listen patiently as stories that may have remained buried for decades start to come to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. One common theme that has echoed consistently over the 15 years I've spent interviewing World War II veterans is how truly united the United States of America became when faced with the gravity of what was at stake during World War II. Ultimately, freedom was at stake, and the value of that freedom was such that people all over this country were willing to do whatever it took to secure and preserve that freedom. It's always amazed me how simply honoring our veterans for what they've done is something that can bring people together today. People that may otherwise disagree on so many fronts can agree that those who put their lives on the line for the rest of us are worthy of our gratitude. And that power of our veterans and their stories to bring us all together was proven once again this week in Washington, D.C., where Congress not only did something important, but leaders from both sides of the aisle during a season where political polarization is extreme as ever, were celebrating together in presenting the Congressional Gold Medal to a group of deserving World War II veterans. The Congressional Gold Medal is the highest civilian honor that Congress can award. Sometimes it gets confusing because there's often a significant lag in time between when Congress approves this honor for a certain group or individual and when the customized medal for that specific entity is actually presented. If you're a regular listener to this program, you've heard over the years about the Congressional Gold Medal going to several collections of World War II veterans. The Tuskegee Airmen, the Women Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs, the Mumford Point Marines, all the Nisei veterans of World War II. There's been a medal for those who served in the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, for Filipino veterans of World War II, for the Doolittle Raiders, for the Native American Code Talkers. Earlier this year, for the crew of the USS Indianapolis, and this week, the latest version of the Congressional Gold Medal was given to the Chinese Americans living and deceased who served our country during World War II. Because of COVID-19, the ceremony had to be conducted virtually. I have the video linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we're going to hear a few excerpts from that, and also hear some of the memories of recipients of that honor over the next hour. The virtual presentation began with a greeting from Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, followed by the presentation of the colors, the singing of the national anthem, and then this invocation from Chaplain of the Senate Dr. Barry Black.
O wise and generous God, the giver of every good and perfect gift, listen to our prayer. Lord, we thank you for the honor and fidelity of Chinese Americans who fought for this nation during World War II. In spite of facing discrimination at home, they more than self, their country loved, and mercy more than life. God, we praise you for this opportunity to acknowledge their courageous contribution to America's freedom with the Congressional Gold Medal. Forgive us for the discrimination they had to face and for our failure to celebrate our common humanity. May this Congressional Gold Medal ceremony remind us that all people are wrapped in a blanket of mutuality and tied to a single garment of destiny. May we also not forget that a day is coming when many who are known last will be first, and many who are now first will be last. We pray in your sovereign name. Amen.
That was Barry Black, chaplain of the U.S. Senate, and aside from Speaker Nancy Pelosi's introduction, the first member of Congress to speak was Aumua Amata Coleman Radowagon, who represents American Samoa, an area which played a vital role in preserving Allied supply lines during World War II.
The Congressional Gold Medal is the highest honor Congress can give. I was so pleased when the Chinese-American World War II Congressional Gold Medal Act was signed into law in December of 2018. Now, Congress is completing this honor with the official presentation ceremony for those incredible veterans and their families. This gold medal ensures that the history of their heroic service is preserved and known by generations to follow. I cannot express how special and humbling it is to have supported this act of Congress and to take part in honoring their courageous service. The entire world is in debt to the Allied veterans of World War II. Together, they triumphed in the great cause of freedom. They enabled generations to live in liberty, peace, and prosperity. This gold medal makes certain the pivotal role of our Chinese-American World War II heroes is never forgotten. They served in every theater of the war, overcoming much. Through their stories, they continue to inspire devotion to freedom. To them, we say a heartfelt thank you. May God bless our veterans. God bless American Samoa and the United States of America. Soy Fua.
Continuing with highlights of that virtual ceremony presenting the Congressional Gold Medal, here's Congresswoman Judy Chu of California.
Today's ceremony is especially meaningful to me because my father, Judson Chu, was one of those veterans. He served in the Army during World War II as a radio communications sergeant in Okinawa. It was a life-changing experience for him. He formed bonds with his fellow service members, men he would never have known otherwise, but whose bonds were strengthened by their shared sense of purpose, that they were serving a cause and a country they believed in. My father passed away in 2015 at the age of 91, and we fulfilled his wishes to be buried in a military cemetery. I can say that up until his very last day, one of the things that he was the proudest of in his life was of his service to his country. What was extraordinary for these 20,000 Chinese American veterans was the choice they made in the face of gross prejudice. Despite facing racial discrimination at home, including the hateful Chinese Exclusion Act that remained in place until 1943, thousands of Chinese Americans like my father signed up to serve in World War II. Anyway, these men and women were proud to serve our country. They deserve our deepest gratitude, and it is with tremendous pride that we honor them today.
I'm not going to belabor this point too much, but you just heard from two members of Congress, one Democrat, one Republican. I didn't tell you which was which, and they didn't tell you either, but you heard them both pointing to something they could agree on, recognizing the service of Chinese-American veterans of World War II. I've seen quite a few of these gold medal ceremonies over the years, and I have to say that the virtual format actually made the clarity and content more compelling than some of the in-person ceremonies. You can see it all on video at hometownheroesradio.com, and if you do, you'll notice that the U.S. Army Band's performance of God Bless America is followed by these words from Admiral Carl Schultz, Commandant of the Coast Guard.
To the nearly 20,000 Chinese-Americans and their families who supported the United States Armed Forces during World War II. Thank you, and congratulations for being recognized for your selfless service to our country. During the Second World War, Chinese Americans were essential crew members aboard virtually every Pacific-based United States Coast Guard cutter. A complement of women served during this war as well. They were known as SPARs, or the Coast Guard Women's Reserve, and they provided critical support to our Coast Guardsmen deployed on cutters off Greenland and Alaska, as well as in the Atlantic and Pacific theaters. They also supported day-to-day Coast Guard domestic operations. One of these Coast Guard spars was Chinese-American Grace Chin. Grace was born in Los Angeles, California in 1920, the fifth of seven children. After studying English at the University of California at Berkeley, Grace became a talented writer and enlisted as a yeoman in the United States Coast Guard to support the war effort, serving in Florida. Coast Guard spar and Chinese American Gloria Toy Jim G performed sentry duty at the Coast Guard District Office in St. Louis. Gloria's identical twin sister Lorraine served as a spar as well. Lorraine maintained communications for the St. Louis District Barracks as a switchboard operator. Both women grew up in the Chinese Quarter of New Orleans. They joined the U.S. Coast Guard together, trained together, and worked together to support the war effort. Today, as we celebrate and finally recognize the patriotism and bravery of our Chinese American soldiers, sailors, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen in the Second World War, let us remember the selfless sacrifice that Chinese American women like Coast Guard spars Grace Chin, Gloria Toy Jim G, and Lorraine provided as well. On behalf of the United States Coast Guard, thank you for your service to our nation.
That was the Commandant of the Coast Guard, Carl Schultz, and also highlighting ways that Chinese Americans contributed to victory in World War II was Air Force Chief of Staff, General C.Q. Brown.
The men and women we honor today weren't always considered equals, weren't in some cases even U.S. citizens, but nonetheless, they committed themselves to support and defend the ideals articulated in our Constitution and distinguished themselves in service during World War II. They were part of the famed Flying Tigers, the 14th Air Service, led by Claire Chennault, and served primarily in the China, Burma, India area of responsibility. It's because of their heroism and commitment to duty, the Army Air Corps credited the Flying Tigers with destroying more than 2,300 enemy aircraft, 350 bridges, 1,200 locomotives, and 700 rail cars, effectively crippling the enemy's logistic supply lines. These veterans are unsung heroes, and many of them never received the simple thanks our country owed them, much less a Congressional Gold Medal. Recognizing the impact of Chinese Americans during World War II is long overdue. These less-known air power giants are most deserving to be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. Your legacy has made our Air Force and our military what it is today, and we are indebted to you for your selfless service, dedication to duty, and all of your sacrifices for this great nation.
That was General C.Q. Brown, Air Force Chief of Staff. Leaders from the Army and Navy shared sentiments as well, and some of the politicians you hear debating most frequently on some of the most rancorous issues appeared back-to-back singing the same tune. Let's hear briefly from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
22,000 Chinese Americans fought in World War II. Nearly a fifth of the entire population in America at that time. They served in every branch and every theater with courage. They wore the uniforms of soldier, airmen, and sailors with pride. They fought and bled and died alongside Americans of all backgrounds. Their mission was simple and singular: defend freedom, and defend it they did. But victory on the battlefield is not their only achievement. They were all trailblazers for a better place, and I'm confident that Chinese Americans will continue to contribute to the American story through public service. Already, we are seeing a new generation, not only of military leaders, but also political leaders. I'm proud to say my home of Bakersfield is represented by two such leaders, Mayor Karen Goh and State Assemblyman Vince Fong. A more inclusive society is the legacy of the Chinese Americans who served in World War II. So, let's complete the unfinished work of a bearing witness to this bravery. The special award is long overdue. Congratulations.
During the war, Chinese Americans served in every branch and in every theater. Infantrymen, engineers, pilots, medics, all of them were patriots to the core. And so we say to you, thank you. A grateful nation pledges to never forget what you did for your country, and to always remember those who never came home.
Everyone knows the United States of America would not be here today without the bravery and sacrifice of generations of veterans. But it's especially humbling to remember how many heroes risk everything for our nation before the nation was even ready to fully accept them. Chinese Americans played a central part in our history long before the Second World War. Their contributions helped build up great American cities on both coasts. Many of them laid the rails that connected those coasts, notwithstanding poor treatment and bad pay. But when the bombs fell on Pearl Harbor and this huge undertaking was pressing upon our nation, the Chinese American community was still viewed by too many as second class. On that day in 1941, and for 2 years after, the Chinese Exclusion Act was still in effect. racial prejudice was still widespread. Yet thousands and thousands of Chinese Americans served in the U.S. Army, the Army Air Forces, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, and in other ways. They risk everything to serve in every corner of the conflict, from the combat fighter pilot who lit up the skies over Germany to a Navy commander who saved his crew from a kamikaze attack in the Pacific, to the nurses' corps lieutenant who tended the wounded in Burma, to the Army Ranger who scaled Point du Hoc on D-Day and beyond. Your ranks included no less than the first Asian American U.S. Senator, the first Asian American flag officer, and the first Asian American graduate of the Naval Academy. Chinese American service members made tremendous sacrifices. Some paid the ultimate price, all in service to a country that had not yet to fully love them back. This key part of the Greatest Generation has not always received enough attention, but that's been changing, and it permanently changes today. It's my joy to help present the long overdue honor to hundreds of honored veterans who are still with us. I know you accept this award on behalf of the many thousands who did not live to see your contributions rewarded with the greatest honor the United States Congress can bestow. So to the veterans joining us, to your comrades who have passed on, and to the families who have preserved these remarkable American stories, thank you and congratulations.
Kevin McCarthy, Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell. If you check out the video online, you'll hear from Nancy Pelosi and others too. You hear those names a lot on the news, but you may not have heard this on the news, and you definitely haven't heard what's coming next. We'll spend the rest of today hearing the memories of a couple of those Chinese American World War II veterans that this new Congressional Gold Medal was created for. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Today, with fewer than 300 Chinese American veterans of the Greatest Generation remaining, it is more important than ever that we honor their service and remember their sacrifice.
That was Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi this week taking part in a truly bipartisan ceremony to award the Congressional Gold Medal to all Chinese American veterans of World War II. A very satisfying moment for people like Murray Lee of the San Diego Chinese Historical Museum. As part of the Chinese American Citizens Alliance, Murray was a strong advocate for this particular Congressional Gold Medal. He and two of his brothers served in World War II.
Everybody knew that they had to go into service as soon as they graduated. And a friend of mine and I said, well, what are our choices? At that time, it was like, well, we're all filled up in the Air Force on these education programs and things like that that we wanted to get into. He says, well, why don't we go and join the Merchant Marine up in Sheepshead Bay, Long Island? So that's where we went. And so when I was up there, I said, well, I'd like to get some special training, so I would like to go to radio school. And they had two radio schools. One was in the harbor there in New York, and another one was in the harbor in Boston. So what they did was, just as soon as I applied and qualified to go, they closed the schools and said, we're filled up. There's only one radio operator on each merchant ship, and we have trained enough now. So we're closing down those schools. I've always seemed to be right behind everything there. And so I said, well, what are my choices? And I said, well, you go into the engine room, or you be a steward, you know, like that's like a busboy and serve meals and things like that, or you go on deck. And I said, I don't want to go in the engine room. I want to know what's going on. If I get out there, there's a torpedo or something. I want to know. I want to be up where I can see what's going on. So I just said to be on deck. We didn't have any choice. The first ship we was going on, they shipped four of us down to the Norfolk to be on a ship that was looking for people. And I know why they were looking for people, because they couldn't keep them, because this was an old ship built back in like 1916, and it didn't have a bit of paint on it. It was 100% rust. But at that time, that steel that they had was pretty good, so it lasted. So they said, okay, have you ever steered a ship? I said, no. Well, get on this wheel and follow this course. At that time, they didn't have automated, you know, steering. It was a compass, magnetic compass. So they said, follow this course. So I did, and I was very good at it in the sense that I could see that the ship would drift. It depends upon the tide or the wind in that. And so I would adjust this to this before it did that, so that I could stay on this course. And they were looking, and, you know, this, you know, wow, this guy can, you know, because to most of the guys that steer, the ship is going like this, winding, you know, because they compensate after it starts to turn. So anyway, when I got to the end of it was up in Boston, we were going to, hauling a load of coal, believe it or not, but it didn't affect the ship since it was all rust anyway. So when I got there, we got paid, and I got more money than these other guys that were with me on a ship, because we made you an acting able-bodied seaman because you were such a good helmsman.
And how old were you at the time?
18.
When you signed up for that, did you have any idea how dangerous that was? Because statistically, being in the Merchant Marines was as dangerous as anything in World War II.
More dangerous. But in 1942, there were more Merchant Marine sailors killed than all other services combined in the Atlantic, because the German U-boats were patrolling the Atlantic, and they weren't encountering any U.S. Navy or anything. At that time, all the efforts of the Navy were in the Pacific. So along the coast, they were sending out patrol boats and private planes and things like that. Even one private plane carried a bomb in and tried by hand to drop it on a U-boat because they could see them, but they couldn't do anything about it because, you know, they were yachts and other kinds of ships along with it. And then Churchill contacted Roosevelt and said, we are an island nation. We are under attack by the Nazis. We cannot survive unless we get your food and supplies. You've got to start sending us stuff. So that's when they started the convoys. So the convoys would go out, and at first the German U-boats would say, well, there's a spot where these convoys don't have air protection out in the middle of the Atlantic. We'll sit there with our wolf packs, they call them, and we'll wait and we'll pick off all these ships because they're not getting support from North America. Well, eventually they closed that gap and they developed radar and sonar. And so then the U-boats came under attack because they could trace it. They even got the code from the German code, so they knew where these guys were going, and then the U-boats were on the run. That was a great turnabout in the Atlantic there.
But were you aware of any of that as a teenager when you signed up?
Well, no. Actually, when I signed up, I was up in the training. The war in Europe had ended. And in fact, I was in Times Square when the Japanese surrendered.
That must have been interesting.
It was, because you know that we have that famous KISS statue here in San Diego. Well, I was there when that was going on. And I remember all these guys doing that. And, of course, I was too bashful to go and grab a girl, you know, that I didn't know and kiss her. But I saw all these guys doing that, these Navy guys, and everybody was celebrating that. My friend and I did meet a couple of girls. And they said, oh, you want to go walk into Central Park or something with us? And I said, okay, we'll go and take a look at that. And so that was kind of interesting period. But we were very fortunate that was the end of hostility. But it wasn't the end of danger, because when we were out in the Atlantic, we had to watch out for floating mines, because it was going up to Antwerp and that. We had a minesweeper going ahead of us. They had me go on the bow one time. I said, why don't you go do look out on the bow? And I said, What got on a bow? If we didn't mind, that's the first place it's going to blow up, right? Now, well, that's your job. Go do it.
So how long did you end up staying in the Merchant Marines?
2 years. Truman wrote something, which I have a copy of, to me and to all the merchant seamen, saying, "We are very thankful for your service in the Merchant Marine. We figure that you have served your 2 years requirement, and you are exempt, you know, from being drafted." And it wasn't until 1980-something that they granted a Merchant Marine veteran status. But then all the veterans' benefits are gone.
So someone who served in the Army or the Navy or the Marines or the Army Air Corps or the Coast Guard, they could go to college and use the GI Bill. But even though you were risking your life, you didn't have that.
I had to work my way through school. I worked nights and weekends on my father's restaurant. Of course, I was going to George Washington University, and they had night classes and weekend classes, so I was taking all these classes. We had a first son, so I hardly saw him for that year because I was working nights and weekends and everything, and finally graduated. I did earn Phi Beta Kappa.
Murray would also earn a master's degree, and there's quite a story behind that. He worked for multiple government agencies. I can't tell you about everything he did because some of it is classified, but I can tell you about the books he's written. Elephant and the Indians, about part of his family history in America. Pretty fascinating. In Search of Gold Mountain, about the contributions of Chinese immigrants in the growth of San Diego and the development of California as a whole. And Through the Eyes of Heroes, in which he captures the exploits of his fellow Chinese American veterans.
I know that researching, interviewing a lot of the Chinese Americans here in San Diego, I ran across quite a number of them that had been sent to China, Western China, where Chiang Kai-shek was still in operation in that area. They went to support the Flying Tigers in that area, those areas. They didn't just end up in Kunming or in one city because they wanted to make it difficult for the Japanese to locate these forces where they were, so they went around to various small towns in that area and established a base, you know, kind of scattered around. So they weren't all together, although at one time, then when they left, they all sort of ended up coming all together, and when they were sent back to the U.S., they gathered up in one area, and some of them said, "Oh, you have the opportunity," this is when the war was over there, "of going down and visiting your home villages back in Canton, Guangdong area, or you can go straight back to the West Coast in the U.S. And some of them decided to take advantage of that and go and visit their home villages and that.
And even in your own family, you had a couple half-brothers who were doing interesting things during World War II.
They were the first Chinese after Pearl Harbor. They're written up in the newspaper, and there's a picture of them. They were in New York at that time. They joined right after Pearl Harbor. They ended up in the U.S. Air Force. One brother, the older one, went to Europe and was based in England and flew with medium bombers 50 missions over enemy territory in France and Germany. When he came back after those 50 missions, and I just can't believe this, because if you have 50 missions and you don't get wounded, you ought to quit. Because that was required. He went and joined the RAF and flew in their medium bombers, which were wooden bombers at that time. Everybody thought, "Well, you're crazy." But anyway, he did that. He loved flying, I guess. And the other brother was flying the hump. We supported Chiang Kai-shek and the troops in Kunming and those areas by bringing in supplies from India. They had to go over the Himalayas. That was nothing easy because these two-engine planes, some of them had a lot of trouble. So he was flying back from China to go back to India to get more supplies than that. The engine faltered on this plane, and they all bailed out, and they bailed out over Burma. The pilot just kept the plane going, sacrificed his life so that everybody got out, and he crashed with the plane, so he was the only casualty out of that, but quite a hero in himself. So they landed in this headhunter country in Burma with a tribe that normally probably they would have lost their heads. But this tribe hated the Japanese because the Japanese were invading Burma from the south. And so they said, "Well, we will walk you guys back through the jungle to India," which was quite a number of days. And so my brother was on that, and they reported that he had a sprained ankle. Some of them had more serious injuries, but he is mentioned by Eric Severide, was on that plane, famous correspondent, war correspondent. And so I have this story, and he wrote this all up in the Reader's Digest, and I thought it's a very interesting story about that. And so they did make it back to India, and where they would be able to continue on and get other planes and get back to flying the hump again. So that's his story.
Well, and in this book, Through the Eyes of Heroes, you have many more Chinese-American veterans who you have interviewed and gotten their story. Some of them are no longer with us. Do you think that the general public has a sense of the contributions of Chinese Americans during World War II?
No, I don't. Maybe even some of the Chinese don't. But that was the whole purpose of this, is to get these interviews of Chinese Americans. They were in various units, from Navy to Marines to Army and all of those. Some of them knew each other. Others may not have, but they all were based here in San Diego, and we had quite a number of Chinese Americans that joined. And a lot of them, when the war was declared, they were in San Diego High School. And all the Chinese that lived in Chinatown went to San Diego High School. That was the only high school, I think, in the area. A lot of them just immediately signed up. But anyway, accumulating all their stories was a major contribution, I think, to the history of Chinese in San Diego.
Well, and I know it's probably hard to pick just one, but is there one story that you came across in putting this book together that just raises your eyebrows or says, wow, that is a hero? I mean, you call it Through the Eyes of Heroes. Who's a hero in this book in your mind?
One of them that I did interview, and that's Gorman Fong. I think that his family's going to have his plaque put up on Mount Soledad, hopefully very soon. I encouraged all of them to do that, and I think one of his sons said, well, I'm going to get it and put it up there. I interviewed him. He had a very interesting story about how he was with this field artillery battalion in 1944. The one big thing that happened to him was in the Battle of the Bulge. Well, Hitler would just told him, go in there, we might lose this war, but we want to drive these guys back to the ocean. They got all their panzer divisions, and they started going back to force all these Americans and British back to where they landed, you know. He was stationed at one place which was right on their route where they were going to be going through. And so he said, well, they considered him a sacrifice unit there. What's that famous correspondent mentioned about him, that they figured that they were gone? Ernie Pyle wrote in the Stars and Stripes that we were already dead, in other words, presumed dead, because we were our sacrifice battery. We saw the colonel and his assistant sitting in their jeep, ready to pull out on the highway, and we were seeing all these foot soldiers marching back carrying their guns. We hear all the rumbling sound of tanks only about a half mile away. We hear these sounds. It was at night. We asked some of those soldiers, hey guys, what's up there? They answered, the Germans are coming right at us. We have a few guns holding them back right now, and you guys will be the last line of defense. Then our marching orders were given to us that could not leave until 0100. By then, the Germans had overrun the position we were in. So that's why we were presumed that we were already dead. We just had the two big guns, 155 howitzers to cover, and 50 caliber machine guns, one on each side of the road. Everybody is going crazy. Nobody wanted to die. They might wonder why we were designated to hold, but our gun positions just happened to be each side of the road. We were just happy to get out alive. So the German panzers were so fast, they just bypassed him. They didn't want to bother with him. And afterwards, he ended up going to Berlin after, we had won that war. He was in Berlin. One of his fellow Americans who was examining a German Luger automatic pistol, while he was doing that, the gun went off and shot Gorman in the leg. And I told Gorman, I said, did you get the Purple Heart for that? He said, no, I didn't get the Purple. I said, yeah, but you were wounded by a German gun, weren't you? I said, you should have gotten a Purple Heart. And there were Chinese in North Africa and in Italy and other places. We have one Chinese in here. His name was Victor Shun, S-C-H-O-O-N. They never allowed Chinese to fly. They couldn't be pilots. That's a discrimination that they had. They always be tail gunners or something like that. But he ended up being captain of a B-17, flying 50 missions out of Italy. And how did he get that? Because they thought he was German. He had this name Schoen, S-C-H-O-O-N, and that was a name given to his father when he came into the country. They would come in and the immigration officer would say, oh, I can't pronounce your Chinese name. I'm just going to call you Schoen. This guy was German, I think. And so they thought he was German, so he became a pilot. And once he became a pilot, they couldn't do much about it. But later on, after he came out of the military, he and his wife were trying to go to a military function in this country, and they wouldn't let him go in. here this guy was flying 50 missions as a B-17 pilot, and then he goes to an event there, and they look at him and say, oh, you and your wife are Chinese, you know, you can't come in here.
Is there something you would say that you want people who read these books to understand, that there's a message you want to convey or communicate that you hope people will hold on to?
Well, I think that after so many years of discrimination, exclusion, and that to show that the Chinese Americans are Americans as well as having Chinese ancestry, that they're Americans and that they are willing to fight for their country and to defend it.
You can link to our complete original interview with Murray Lee at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, another Chinese American veteran who will be receiving the latest Congressional Gold Medal, Hometown Heroes, will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you pull up the video of this week's Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony for the Chinese American Veterans of World War II, you will see several surviving veterans accepting their medals, all very grateful that they lived to see this day. Another veteran who feels that way is Ray Lee of Fresno, California. He's had to adjust to meeting his normal Thursday morning coffee club on Zoom now because of COVID-19, and he's waiting for the Veterans Memorial Museum to reopen. There's a room there named in his honor for all of his volunteer work at the museum over the years. Ray grew up in the small town of Coalinga, California, where his family owned the China Cafe.
We had about two Asian family beside ourselves, one Korean and two Chinese family. Two of them was running out grocery store, and one had one Korean family working out in the oil field, Standard 25D, and that was about it.
Well, you told me your class of 1942, so that tells me that your senior year at Coalinga High School, the world changed a little bit. Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
You better believe it. Me and my dad was going down to the restaurant. We were riding in this vehicle. And then we got to the back alley, we pulled in, and our neighbor next door had a dry cleaning establishment, and he hollered over the fence that Pearl Harbor had been attacked by the Japanese. And we didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. I said, where's Pearl Harbor? My dad said, I don't know. He asked me, do you know where it is? I said, no, I don't. So we had the radio going on all night, and found out it was in Hawaii. And it was quite a shock, yeah. And then we was thinking, geez, we're going to have to get involved in this, which we did.
Well, and what was it like at school the next day?
Everybody knew about Pearl Harbor. Everybody was in a state of shock. And we had several high school students that graduated before our class did. They were in the military. Some of them were lost in Corregidor and when they got overrun by the Japanese in the Philippines.
Well, and you know, I've talked to a lot of Japanese Americans who were in this area at the time, and I've heard how their life changed, and of course, they got locked up and put behind barbed wire. But I've also heard stories about Chinese Americans being mistaken for Japanese Americans. Is that something that happened to you?
Yes, they did. I was stationed at Camp Cook. I decided to take a weekend pass to go to Santa Barbara. So I took a weekend pass, and I was walking down the sidewalk by myself, and two Marines were walking toward me, and they were talking to each other. I knew they were up to something no good. They were recruits. They come toward me, and they walked me right off the sidewalk. I didn't say anything. I just went off the sidewalk, and that was it. And they turned around and looked at it and started laughing. I said, okay. I said, in case I find you on the battlefield, I'll start laughing at you. Remember what happened. But anyhow, I didn't see those guys anymore. They were recruits.
Well, when did you end up in the Army? And what about your brother? Which one of you went in the service first?
My brother did. He went in the Navy first. And I tried to get in the Navy, but the quota was all filled up. I tried to get in the Air Force. The quota was filled up. So I tried the organization that I really liked, but there was no opening. So I decided, I'm not going to wait any longer. I went down the draft board. I told my head I want an immediate induction. I want to get this thing over with. So I volunteered, had the draft board take me in.
How did your family feel about that, about you and your brother going off to war?
Well, they had no choice. They knew that we had to do it. We had to go and do our duty. We had to go and show people that we were proud of what we are, so we all volunteered. They sent us to Camp San Luis Obispo for amphibious training. When they say amphibious training, I knew where we were headed for, Pacific. So we took a Camp Cook, went to Camp Cook, Camp San Luis Obispo. They run us up and down the Pacific coast, landing on the 101 highway. They had to stop the traffic, and we had to land there and participate in invasion. All infantry guys go up the hill, and we come in with the LCVP, and we had the life belt around our side. And then we drop. As soon as we hit the beach, we drop the life belt, and then you run. You can't run. Everybody was seasick. The sand was sandy. You know how sandy? You're trying to carry heavy equipment, a litter or something like that. You just can't move. Just like you're just paralyzed. And the Marine standing there, he was instructing us, run, run, get off with the ground, run. Trying to get us off the ground. We were too sick, seasick. We were riding in those LCVP, the circle, smelling the diesel smoke. Everybody was sick.
That doesn't sound very encouraging. That wouldn't give you a whole lot of confidence to do that for real overseas.
Well, we were supposed to land, our division was supposed to land in Tokyo Bay. There were three divisions involved, the 95th, the 97th, and the 104th. We were supposed to be the frontal attack. We were supposed to be involved in that. Good thing that I signed an armistice. Otherwise, I won't be around to tell you what happened. Yeah. But anyhow, the war came to a halt, so we landed. They didn't have no pier to unload the troops. We had to take our LCVP, hit the beach, get off, just like you're making a dry run on an invasion.
But you saw a whole lot more of the world before that. So you're training for the Pacific, but then the Battle of the Bulge happens, and there's casualties, casualties, casualties. Yeah. So they pull your division and say, you're going to Europe?
I was surprised. I thank the Lord that we were going back to Europe instead of going to the Pacific. If we'd gone to the Pacific, I wouldn't be here to tell you what I was involved in. Anyhow, we order changed, so we had to go back to Camp Kilmer. Well, that's where we shipped out, POE. Wake up next morning, I never seen so many ship around us. Man, there was a bunch of ships.
So what did you encounter once you got to Europe?
Well, shocked me when we landed in Le Havre, France, and then we all took off, get into the 2.5-ton truck that took us to Fay Camp. And I looked around at the harbor, everything was all shot up, burned, completely demolished. I'd never seen so much wreckage. Man, it was a shock. And then we went to the village, and I seen burnt-out buildings, and it was more of a shock. And then they got us to Camp Lucky Strike. They had Camp Lucky Strike, Camp Ogo, Camp different cigarette. They had different camp to prepare yourself to get ready to go to get assigned to one of the army that's on the line. So the engineer had us learned how to dig up mines, landmines, booby traps. We didn't know anything about it. They were blowing off explosives all the time just to get us used to the sound. And that was kind of scary. And then we had to learn how to dig up the mine. I had three guys in the line go out and dig up the mine, Teller mine, glass mine, S mine, and I didn't know what the heck S mine and booby trap, all that stuff, but I sure learned a lot. The engineer was blowing up explosives just to get us accustomed to it.
Here you're trained to be a medic, and now they're saying you're going to be disabling these mines that can kill you if you make a wrong move. How nerve-wracking is that to try to pull up a mine without it going off?
Well, it's, you know, they're teaching us when you probe into the ground, you go at a certain degree. You don't go directly on top. You might set off that explosive. So they tell us when you dig up a mine, you holler, mine, two of your buddy back off, and you're responsible for the mine. And he said, never dig up the first mine. They have another one behind it, the pressure mine underneath it. You lift off the top of another one, goes off. So the Germans know are really smart. They were really clever. Everything that they manufactured was right to the teeth, not like a Mickey Mouse. They were completely to the teeth. They got fine equipment.
I'm just thinking, is that where you celebrated your 21st birthday? In Europe, right after you got there?
Well, I didn't have time to think about that. All I was thinking about, hoping the heck I'd come out alive. That was the main thing. We were thinking about that. We don't want to step on a mine, and that was it. They got a lot of mine out there. Yeah. So they had to light up an area with a ribbon, stay on the path. Otherwise, a lot of mine field around you. Especially in France, they had a lot of minefield. I didn't know what a mine was, but I shouldn't find out.
I'm sure there are a lot of things that you saw that you'd never seen before. Where all did you guys go with the 97th Infantry Division?
Well, we were assigned to the Rhine River. We had to clean up the Ruhr pocket. They had a pocket up there where our division went up there and cleaned it out. And we took Cologne and Dusseldorf, those two big cities. Just kept going. We were assigned to old General Patton. That guy, he didn't know when to stop. He was constantly going, you know. Every time he could start going, he said, where are we headed for? Nobody knows. We're just going, got our orders to head straight ahead. We go end up in Czechoslovakia. We liberated Pilsen. Our division liberated Pilsen. And then went 3-4 miles out of Pilsen to a little small town, Mies, M-I-E-S. That's where we got ordered to come back because General Patton wanted to go to Berlin. We were headed for Berlin. It was over there in the end of Czechoslovakia. We was going to head to Berlin, and Eisenhower told him to come back, let the Russian take the casualty. So we came back to Germany again, regroup ourselves. I was up there at the battalion aid station, and we would have some patient come in. They were wounded. Well, we had a battalion surgeon. He would check them out and decide what to give them. So we would follow up on the battalion surgeon's order. We give them bandages and few things like medication, stuff like that. In a serious case, we would send them back to the clearing company. They would send them back to an evacuation hospital where they had more equipment to take care of the person. We just have just a minor item up as like having a Band-Aid. We just give them Band-Aid treatment. That's all we had up there. We didn't have all the heavy equipment like the evacuation hospital.
So are you saying you didn't see too many of the serious wounds? Or were there some things that you witnessed that you still think back on and you say, man, that guy sacrificed a lot for his country?
Yeah, I seen some, I don't want to talk about it, I seen some pretty bad stuff. We had some German prisoner come in, the poor guy was shot up pretty bad, and we couldn't travel at night. We stayed indoor because if you travel at night, you would get shot. So we stayed in a little house, and this guy, German prisoner, was in the other room. He was mooning all night long. Man, we couldn't sleep. He was mooning all night long till daylight, and it was pretty hard to take. And in the morning, we evacuated him on a litter. We took him out, get ready to put him in the ambulance, and I said, he's gone. Don't use put him in the ambulance. We might as well leave him right here for the German civilian to put him away. You know, that was something I never forget.
Did that experience of being a medic with the 97th Infantry Division as you're going across Europe, you know, in early 1945, did that give you an impression or an understanding of how much courage these American soldiers had? Can you maybe give us an example that comes to mind of what illustrated that for you?
Well, we came up on the Rhine River at night. We were assigned on a certain area, and it was raining cats and dogs and lightning, and we were standing out there like some troop back over to the German side. They were setting both sides were reconnaissance, and they were checking our defense out, and we were checking those guys out. And finally, we got word that the 101st Airborne was going to take that position, so we moved out. The 101st came in, took the line of defense right there on the Rhine River. I was glad I didn't have no weapon. Boy, I sure feel naked out there. What are we doing out here? It was just like a bunch of jaybirds, you know, no weapon, just a medical kit. That was crazy.
And how did you cross the Rhine?
Across the Rhine, they had a pontoon bridge. An engineer got together, got the pontoon bridge, so we went across in our ambulance. We had an ambulance. Our company had some ambulance, and I was in the litter platoon. We did all the dirty work, you know. The other guy, they sit back and they were in the luxury. We did the dirty work. We moved into this little town, little village-like, and we seen a lot of white sheet hanging out on the window, the doors in the village, and we was out there chewing a rag. Pretty soon I looked up. There was a company of infantry was coming up the road. There were platoon size. They were on each side of the road, and the captain was leading them, and he come up to me, and he said, "What are you people doing up here?" I said, "Isn't this town taken?" He said, "Hell no." And I said, "Wow, we're in trouble." So I took off, and he continued his way up forward. That was the closest I ever seen. We took the town without knowing it wasn't taken. Man, I tell you, the OC, the company commander, he really screwed up and almost got us all killed. Good thing this infantry company came out and asked us what the hell we was doing up here.
So you're walking around without a care, not knowing you're in danger and there's enemy all around you.
Yeah, that's true. We heard shots going on, firing going on. We didn't know what was going on until they came up and told us we were not supposed to be up there. And we were up there ahead of the infantry. Boy, I tell you, that was one of the screwiest moments I've ever experienced.
And I know some of the stuff is difficult to talk about, and I'm not trying to twist your arm. So if you say you don't want to talk about it, don't. You're 95 years old now. It's been 75 years since all this happened. Are there days where you still, in your mind, see or hear or smell something from 75 years ago?
Well, I never forget the smell of death. It's something that you never forget the smell. A body odor, it's one smell you never forget. They had a lot of these cases come up. They were on the wagon. They were all covered with straw. And we were downwind, and then we got a pretty good whiff of it. And we knew exactly what was going on when we got the smell. They were carrying these civilian. They were all on the big wagon. They were covered with straw. All you see was just feet hanging out, bare feet hanging out, and you never forget. There was quite a few civilian casualty I seen, and the smell was horrific, especially when you're downwind.
Did you have a clear understanding of what you were doing there and why it was so important for all you Americans to be there?
Well, we were in there for the service of our country, to liberate the country and help the people out. That was our job, and I was kind of happy to be one of the group that was there to help the people out, liberate and serve my country. And appreciate for what the country had done for us since I was a kid. And I look around, most of my buddies are gone. I'm very fortunate. The man upstairs taking care of me, so I'm very grateful for that.
And we are grateful for Ray Lee, not to mention the 20,000 other Chinese-American veterans of World War II, as well as the 16 million American men and women who served in our armed forces during that time. You can watch that entire virtual gold medal ceremony at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Once again, our veterans giving us something that even those who so often disagree can find some common ground around. Thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.